Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 06-3135, United States of America versus Jerron Bryce, also known as Jay Bird, also known as Daddy, also known as Bird, also known as Jay Appellant. Mr. Bonsib for the appellant, Mr. Spiegelhalter for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jerron Bryce sold crack to a crackhead. He pulled out a gun to that crackhead. He sold crack and marijuana to make money. By the way, we don't want you to think about those offenses and that conduct as you evaluate whether or not he is guilty of the charges, because that only goes to assessing the credibility of the person who made those statements about him. We want you to ignore that, if you will, pink elephant in the room. And by the way, Jerron Bryce carries a gun. And by the way, Jerron Bryce admitted to killing a person. And he gave the person who said this the details, but we're not going to go into them. And by the way, it really makes no difference, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, whether or not he ever committed a murder. We're just letting you hear that so that you can assess those statements as they relate to the credibility of the witness for the government who made those statements. And we want you to put that green elephant that is in the room out of your mind. Now, if it please the court, what does that tell us about what we think about Jerron Bryce before the jury even considers the issue of the weight of the evidence in this case? But that's not all. We then hear from a so-called expert in the area of prostitution, who comes in and says she knows nothing about Jerron Bryce, and she knows nothing about the case, and nothing about the witnesses, and very little about the District of Columbia, but some 20 years ago, she talked to some people. And so she thinks she knows what pimps do. And she tells the ladies and gentlemen of the jury that pimps, in order to maintain discipline, engage in ritualistic beatings and thrashings, the use of coat hangers, they throw salt on wounds and bust eardrums, they engage in degradation rituals, including oral sex in front of others, scrubbing for the floor with a toothbrush, tying up their ladies, inserting things in their vaginal and anal areas, stripping them down, calling them names, throwing girls in the back of trunks, and make them stay there for days at a time. And that evidence, if it please the court, is grabbed by the prosecutor, both as she predicts it in her opening and uses it in her concluding statement to say, this expert told you what it's about. And even though she knows nothing about the evidence in this case, that evidence can be considered by you in deciding whether or not Mr. Bryce is guilty.
Isn't that exactly the facts of U.S. v. Anderson?
No, with all due respect, it is not. Dr. Lee was allowed to testify in Anderson. But the Anderson case, which was cited by the government on the issue of admissibility, was decided on a question of relevance. Was the testimony relevant? And the court, in concluding in Anderson not to reverse the conviction, didn't really say, it said it sort of was relevant, but it also said it was over the line. But in view of the other evidence in that case, viewing the trial record as a whole, they said it did not seem that it was necessary to have her testimony, but that it was harmless in view of the other evidence in the case. They said that the claims of prejudice in allowing her testimony reflected legitimate concerns because of the inherent danger with expert testimony biasing the jury. Now, it is clear that in Anderson, that conviction was sustained. But when you look at the manner in which it was addressed, it was a relevance to some degree a 403 issue, and on the 403 issue, the court ultimately concluded that it was harmless. In this case, there's nothing in this record to suggest that this woman is qualified under Daubert or anything else in an area that possesses any degree of scientific reliability. And when you look at what she predicates her testimony on, it's conversations with people on a basis over a number of years without any ability to translate that to the facts of this case. And in this case, and it particularly becomes relevant as the trial court makes sentencing determinations at the end, she addresses issues of force and violence and essentially is telling the jury, if you're a pimp, this is what you do. In this case, that allowed the jury, if they believed that Mr. Bryce was involved in prostitution, to jump to the ultimate conclusion to say, if he's a pimp, he does all of these horrible things, and the government then used that as a basis, in part, to argue to the jury that the credibility of the three complaining parties in this case was a matter they should give credit to. The jury clearly did not take what the three complaining witnesses said 100% to heart because they acquitted Mr. Bryce of the force and violence related matters. What would they have done had this evidence of murders and drug dealing and this, what I, with all due respect, call gobbledygook expert testimony, was not included in the record? In this case, Mr. Bryce did not have the opportunity.
What was his defense on the charge regarding the 14-year-old girl?
Obviously, he did not testify. His defense was challenging the credibility of the evidence against him, their credibility.
Was it her age that he challenged, or was it the fact that she was a prostitute or that she was working with him?
I think it
wasn't just her testimony, it was other witnesses too. You said, what would the jury have done? And let's explore that. What was his defense to that charge?
His defense was that the quality of the government's evidence did not measure up to the point where the jury should have had confidence to the degree of proof beyond a reasonable doubt that when she said these things happened, they happened. He didn't testify, she did. So it was her credibility that was directly at issue. If the jury believed her, he would be guilty. If they did not believe her, then he would be acquitted, strictly challenging the quantum and the quality of the government's evidence. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Steve Spiegelhalter, and I represent the United States in this matter. The government has asked that the court affirm all of the convictions that the jury passed down on the appellant Jaron Bryce, and has asked that the sentence be affirmed in all respects save the one that was conceded in the last footnote of the government's brief, in which the government stated that the case should be remanded for the trial court to set forth more clearly the basis for its finding that KH suffered serious bodily injury, a finding that resulted in a 2-point enhancement to Jaron Bryce's sentence. I will address a couple of the issues that came up in appellant's argument, the first being the evidence concerning testimony that the appellant had claimed that he had murdered another individual, as well as testimony that appellant Jaron Bryce had distributed drugs to one crackhead and had sold drugs on another occasion. That evidence, as the trial court found, was intrinsic with respect to the murder, to the crimes that were charged. The key question in this case is, why were these women with Jaron Bryce? Were they with appellant because he had induced them to engage in prostitution, or were they with him for some completely innocuous reason? That was the key issue in this case. The government charged, the grand jury charged Jaron Bryce with using force and fear to induce Shaquita Proctor to engage in prostitution. And indeed, there was no greater evidence in Shaquita Proctor's mind that she had to fear appellant than the testimony she gave that Jaron Bryce had said to her, yes, I have used my gun. Yes, I have committed a murder. because appellant, as the record reflected repeatedly, used death threats against his prostitutes, against his victims, to induce them to commit this other crime of prostitution. There is no greater evidence that the government could have adduced. Moreover, there were strong limiting instructions that were given that the jury was not to consider, and there was one misstatement in the argument earlier, which was that the claim of homicide was only to be used for the credibility of the witness that was on the stand. That is an instruction that was given with respect to the drug dealing testimony, but with respect to the testimony concerning the murder, the limiting instruction was more on point, and it said that you are to consider it for the state of mind of the individual who was testifying. And that state of mind of Shaquita Proctor was an issue for the jury to decide whether she was with Jaron Bryce as a friend for some innocuous reason or because she feared that she could not leave him without losing her life. With respect to the testimony that Jaron Bryce on a couple of occasions had distributed drugs, the government did not seek to introduce that testimony. That testimony was a surprise to the government, as the prosecutor had told the court. Months before, the government expected that the testimony would be that Jaron Bryce's only source of income was from prostitution, from pimping. Moreover, there was a strong limiting instruction that the jury was not to consider that evidence at all for any purpose of deciding whether Jaron Bryce was guilty of any of the charges that have been lodged.
Was there an objection to that answer?
To the first claim, there was not, Your Honor. In fact, the first time that Shaquita Proctor testified about Jaron Bryce using a gun to threaten a crackhead who owed him money because of a drug sale, the appellant's counsel, defense counsel below, chose strategically not to object, and that was what the defense counsel told the court was it was a strategic decision not to object. And so on that basis, really there's no claim other than plain error at best on that first. To the second instance, this limited instance, there was an immediate objection. There was a very strong limiting instruction. And I think something that lays over this entire case is the strength of the evidence, and that if there was an error, which it's hard to see how there was given how the court treated the evidence as soon as it came out, there was a strong limiting instruction, but that was harmless. There was overwhelming testimony, and the court alluded to this when talking to appellant's counsel. There was overwhelming evidence of appellant's guilt on every count. A number of victims who testified consistently with one another, physical evidence, cell phone records, records of Jaron Bryce moving these women between hotels around the country. And moreover, more to the point, and this goes to the other claim as well, the jury clearly discerned between all the charges that faced appellant. The jury clearly decided that they would not, the jurors would not punish him simply because he had claimed to have committed a homicide, or simply because, for instance, Dr. Lee had testified that some other pimps are even more violent than Jaron Bryce's. On the contrary, the jury acquitted appellant of the only claim that would have, of the only charge that would have required the jury to find that Jaron Bryce was a violent individual, and that's how he induced his victims to stay with him. And touching on that briefly, then, the expert testimony as well. This court addressed in Bailey an instance where the expert testified that the expert did not know all the facts of the case, had not investigated the case, and instead testified about general experience. As this court has stated repeatedly, individuals may testify about a general modus operandi. As Judge Tatel suggested, Anderson really does dispose of the claim here, and Lee, which is post-Daubert in 2003, reiterated the holdings of Anderson, that really this kind of testimony, this very generalized testimony, could not shake the jury and invade the jury's fact-finding province. Daubert itself suggested, and this is what happened in this case, that cross-examination is the way to attack, quote, shaky but admissible evidence. The government certainly does not concede that this testimony was shaky, but if appellant feels it was shaky, then cross-examination, and there was a lengthy cross-examination, is the way to solve that.
Is it correct that the only objection to the expert was as to the relevance of the expert's testimony as distinct from the expert's qualifications?
It really was about the expert's qualifications. We're left to intuit a little bit what defense counsel meant. The defense counsel opposed an objection that said we object under Daubert, and then talked about how the standard was low for experts to testify, and it sounded like defense counsel was talking about qualifications, not relevance, but Daubert itself does in some tangential way also address the issue of relevance. But relevance has, of course, been completely disposed of in the Anderson case and in the Long case after it. With respect to the qualifications of Dr. Lee, the only qualification she needs is some specialized knowledge that would assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence or determine a fact and issue. And in this case, her testimony did both of those things. With respect to understanding the evidence, there is an entire foreign language that attends this practice of prostitution. Issues of when a victim is out of pocket, when a victim is reckless eyeballing, what it means to brand a prostitute, which is something that was done in this case. But there's a whole foreign concept that there's no real argument that these things are in the common experience of a juror. And in fact, this testimony was necessary for the jurors to understand even the words they heard, much less what they meant for the charges in this case.
I'm going to go back a little bit. Which of the pieces of evidence that he had murdered somebody, that he pulled a gun on a crackhead, that he dealt in cocaine, which one of those, if any, did the government give notice to the defense counsel prior to trial?
None of those specifically. There was a notice concerning the distribution of drugs and alcohol to the victims themselves to induce them to engage in prostitution. And that's actually a testimony that came out, which was that they were given drugs and alcohol if they engage in sex acts. It was almost a form of payment or a way to make it possible for them to do that.
One of the reasons that you're arguing that this is intrinsic evidence is that skirts Rule 404B's notice requirement.
Oh, I think we're arguing that it's intrinsic because it is intrinsic, Your Honor. The government...
But how do you define what's intrinsic and what's not intrinsic?
Well, if it's evidence that would not require some sort of inference about the character of the individual who was charged, then it's intrinsic. But the government...
That's a test for 404B, too. I mean, if it's intrinsic, is the defense entitled to a limiting instruction?
No, under this court's... holding in Bowie specifically said repeatedly that was one of the effects of it being intrinsic. But in this case, importantly, the government actually requested a limiting instruction, and the trial court gave a limiting instruction. And defense counsel below, requested that those not be repeated.
Well, you know my position on this whole issue. I think the intrinsic, non-intrinsic is an impossible standard. It really is very standardless, and all it does is really skirt Rule 404B, and it does away with the notice requirement, and also threatens to deprive the defendant of a limiting instruction on what the jury can consider the evidence for. So,
well, I want to be very clear about one thing, which is that the evidence of distribution to a crackhead or distribution to a third party, not the victims in this case, was not evidence that the government sought at all to introduce.
But it came out spontaneous.
Correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, I understand.
But with respect to the claim of murder, the government did give advance notice, albeit on the day that the testimony was going to come in, did give notice to trial counsel so that trial counsel could look up cases that might be relevant to it. But the trial court...
Does 404B require pretrial notice?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I think the government's practice is to give it in time for the defense to use it. I see my time has expired. If the court has no further questions, the government requests that all convictions be affirmed and that the sentence be affirmed in all respects, save the one the government has conceded. Thank you.
It please the court. I believe the government's position is correct with respect to the significance of the murder testimony as being important to the government's case to show the degree to which they wanted to suggest to the jury that Mr. Bryce used violence. So the issue of whether it is harmless or not harmless, the government, I think, has taken, at least by their concession, out of the case. If it was improperly admitted, they have identified it as a critical piece, and frankly, it would be impossibly intertwined with the jury's determination and evaluation of Mr. Bryce's character and him as an individual.
Well, it went to count two, right?
No, it goes to him overall. As the government said, it isn't just the force and violence. It is the inducement. It is the whole atmosphere they tried to create about how Mr. Bryce was dealing with the women in this case. And they put the defendant in an absolutely untenable position. Without getting necessarily into the notice versus non-notice, the fact that this comes up on the day of trial and somebody says, I heard Mr. Bryce say he committed a murder and we can't give you the details, and if you want to challenge that and you're sitting there at that trial table representing Mr. Bryce, what are you going to do? You're going to say, the only way I can challenge this is to ask about the details and dig yourself a deeper hole not knowing what the person's going to say? There's no way when this kind of evidence comes out.
You know, counsel, the fact of the matter is there's a good deal of evidence in criminal trials that comes in that is almost impossible for the defense to challenge. That's not what we mean by prejudice under Rule 403. It's not prejudice from the weight of the evidence. It's unfair prejudice.
I understand that.
And if this witness testified to a particular instance in which the individual said, I killed somebody, and put her in fear, then yes, it's very difficult. But that's not prejudicial in the sense that the federal rules use the term prejudice.
It is, with all due respect, our position is it is unfairly prejudicial. It was unnecessary in this case. There was other evidence of him possessing a weapon. There was other evidence the government could rely upon. This went well over the line and was not necessary. It wasn't an allegation of killing somebody involved in this.
Am I right in remembering there was no 403 objection to that, to the gun, the murder?
Well, I think there was a broad-based objection to it all. Frankly, I don't remember the precise language that counsel used, but there was a hearing out of the presence of the jury where the whole impact of that, it being extrinsic to the case and therefore prejudicial, not relevant, I think was thoroughly fleshed out.
And clearly relevant.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor. I think it's not relevant. If it's extrinsic, if he went out and he killed somebody totally unrelated to this case, and the woman who asked the question, who elicited the answer, is the one who elicited the information. He didn't present that to her to put fear in her mind. He responded to a question. That's unrelated. It is not relevant. It is not intrinsic. We would submit.
It makes a fact of consequence to the trial more likely with that evidence than without it. That is the test of relevance. Is it more likely with that evidence that he used force or violence against this particular individual prostitute? With that evidence or without it? The answer is clearly it's more likely. It doesn't have to prove it. It's just more likely. That's all. So I don't think you get anywhere with the relevance. Maybe you get unfair prejudice, cumulative, and that's what I understood you'd be arguing.
Well, initially it was in propensity. It is not something that was on a 403 basis, on a 404 basis. It wasn't and should not have been part of this case. Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.